This is, the first excerpt is from the introduction. Each woman responds to the crisis that breast cancer brings to her life out of a whole pattern, which is the design of who she is and how her life has been lived. The weave of our everyday existence is the training ground for how we handle any crisis. I am a post-mastectomy woman who believes our feelings need voice in order to be recognized, respected, and of use. I do not wish my anger and pain and fear about cancer to fossilize into yet another silence, nor to rob me of whatever strength can lie at the core of this experience, openly acknowledged and examined. For other women of all ages, colors, and sexual identities who recognize that imposed silence about any area of our lives is a tool for separation and for powerlessness, and for myself, I have tried to voice some of my feelings and thoughts about the travesty of prosthesis, the pain of amputation, the function of cancer in a profit economy, confrontations with mortality, the strength of women loving, and the power and rewards of self-conscious living. Breast cancer and mastectomy are not unique experiences. They are ones being shared by thousands of American women. Each of these women has a particular voice to be raised in what must become a female outcry against all preventable cancer, as well as against the secret fears that allow those cancers to flourish. May these words serve as encouragement for other women to speak out, to act out of our experience with cancer and with other threats of death. For silence has never brought us anything of worth. Most of all, may these words underline the possibilities of self-healing and the richness of living for all women. There is a commonality of isolation and painful reassessment which is shared by all women with breast cancer, whether this commonality is recognized or not. It is not my intention to judge the woman who chooses the path of prosthesis or the woman who chooses the path of silence and invisibility. The woman who wishes to be, quote, the same as before. She has survived on another kind of courage, and she is not alone. Each of us struggles daily with the pressures of conformity, the loneliness of difference, from which those choices seem to offer escape. I only know that those choices do not work for me, nor for other women who, not without fear, have survived cancer by scrutinizing its meaning within our lives and by attempting to integrate this crisis into useful strengths for change. I have learned much in the 18 months since my mastectomy. My visions of a future I can create have been honed by the lessons of my own limitations. I wish, however, to give form with honesty and precision to the pain, faith, labor, and loving which this period of my life has translated into strength for me. Sometimes fear still stalks me like another malignancy, sapping energy and power and attention from my work. A cold becomes sinister, a cough, lung cancer, a bruise, leukemia. Those fears are most powerful when I do not give them voice. Close upon their heels will come the fury that I cannot shake them. But I am learning to live beyond fear by living through it. And in the process, learning to turn fury at my own limitations into a more creative energy. I have come to realize that if I wait until I am no longer afraid to act, to write, to speak, to be, I'll be sending messages on the Ouija board, little cryptic complaints from the other side. So will we all. When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less important whether or not I am afraid. As women, we were raised to fear. If I cannot banish fear completely, I can learn to count with it much less than what I was taught. For then, fear becomes not some tyrant against which I waste energy fighting, but a companion, not a particularly desirable one, but one whose knowledge can be very useful. Living a self-conscious life, under the pressure of time, I work with the consciousness of death at my shoulder, not constantly, but often enough to leave a mark upon all of my life's decisions, all of my actions. And it does not matter whether death comes next week or 30 years from now. This consciousness has given my life another breath. It helped shape the words I speak, the ways I love, my politic of action, the strength of my vision and purpose, and the depth of my appreciation for living. I would lie if I did not speak of loss. Any amputation is a physical and psychic reality that must be integrated into a new sense of self. The absence of my breast is a recurrent sadness, but certainly not one that dominates my life. When other one-breasted women hide behind the mask of prosthesis or the dangerous fantasy of reconstruction, I find little support in the broader female environment for a rejection of what feels like a cosmetic sham. But I believe that socially sanctioned prostheses is merely another way of keeping women with breast cancer silent and separate from each other. For instance, what do you think would happen if an army of one-breasted women descended upon Congress and demanded that the use of carcinogenic fat-stored hormones in beef feed be outlawed? Do you realize what you eat every day? I have found that battling despair does not mean closing my eyes to the enormity of the tasks of effecting change, nor does it mean ignoring the strength and the barbarity of those forces which are aligned against us. It does, however, mean teaching, surviving, and fighting with the most important resource I have, myself, and taking joy in those battles. It means for me recognizing the enemy outside and the enemy within, and knowing that my work is part of a continuum of women's work, of reclaiming this earth and our power, and knowing that this work did not begin with my birth, nor will it end with my death. And it means knowing that within this continuum, my life and my love and my work has particular power and meaning relative to others. It also means trout fishing on the Manisqua River at dawn and tasting that green silence and knowing that this beauty too is mine forever. When I refer to prostheses, some of you may not know what it is. Right after operations for breast cancer, the American Cancer Society Reach for Recovery usually, which does on one hand a very good service, usually presents a lamb's wool puff, which is stuck in the bra, to have it seem as if things are, quote, just the same as before, which of course is a travesty, because everyone knows that a puff of lamb's wool is not feel anything at all like one's breast, but it's a progression, of course, of secrecy, and then you graduate to silicone, right, form, so forth. This becomes really very important in some ways because many women are never allowed, you see, the space or the time to feel lost and to move beyond it. There is only pretense. The second piece that I'm going to read deals a little bit with that and some of the occurrences that happened, if I can. Okay. After a mastectomy, for many women, there's a feeling of wanting to go back, of not wanting to persevere through the experience to whatever enlightenment might be at the core of it. It is this feeling, this nostalgia, which is encouraged by much of the post-surgical counseling. This regressive tie to the past is emphasized by the concentration upon breast cancer as a cosmetic problem, one which can be solved by a prosthetic device. I am talking here about the need for every woman to live a considered life. The necessity for that consideration grows and deepens as one faces directly one's own mortality. For as we open ourselves more and more to the genuine conditions of our lives, women become less and less willing to tolerate those conditions unaltered or to passively accept destructive and external controls over our lives and our identities. 10 days after having my breast removed, I went to my doctor's office to have the stitches taken out. This was my first journey out since coming home from the hospital, and I was really looking forward to it. Francis had washed my hair for me. It was black and shining, with my new gray hairs glistening in the sun. Color was starting to come back into my face, and I wore the most opalescent of my moonstones and a single floating bird dangling from my right ear in the name of grand asymmetry. With an African kente cloth tunic and my new leather boots, I looked fine. And I knew I looked fine. With that brave, newborn security of a beautiful woman, having come through a very hard time and being very glad to be alive. When I walked into the doctor's office, I was quite pleased with myself, actually, all things considered. I was pleased with the way I felt, with my flair, and with my own style. The doctor's nurse, a charmingly bright and steady woman of about my own age, who had always given me a feeling of quiet, no-nonsense support on my other visits, called me into the examining room, and on the way she asked me how I was feeling. "Pretty good," I said, half expecting her to make some comment, right? "You're not wearing a prosthesis," she said, a little anxiously and not at all like a question. "No," I said, thrown off my guard for a minute, "it really doesn't feel right." Usually supportive and understanding, the nurse now looked at me very urgently and disapprovingly and told me that even if it didn't look exactly right, it was, quote, "better than nothing," unquote, and that as soon as my stitches were out, then I could be fitted for a real form. "You will feel so much better with it on," she said. "And besides, we really like you to wear something, at least when you come into the office. Otherwise, it's bad for the morale of the office." I could hardly believe my ears. I was too outraged to speak, but this was only the first such assault on my right to define and reclaim my own body. Because here we were, in the offices of one of the top breast cancer surgeons in New York City. Every woman there either had a breast removed, might have to have a breast removed, or was afraid of having a breast removed. And every woman there could have used a reminder that having one breast did not mean her life was over, nor that she was less a woman, nor that she was condemned to the use of placebo in order to feel good about herself. Yet a woman who has one breast and refuses to hide that fact, a woman who is attempting to come to terms with a changed landscape and a changed timetable of life, with her own body and pain and beauty and strength, that woman is seen as a threat to the morale of a breast cancer surgeon's office. Yet when Moshe Dayan, the Prime Minister of Israel, stands up in front of Parliament or on television with an eye patch over his empty eye socket, nobody tells him to go get a glass eye. Right? Or that he's bad for the morale of the troops. The world sees him as a warrior with an honorable wound, a loss of a piece of himself which he has marked and mourned and moved beyond. And if you have trouble dealing with Moshe Dayan's empty eye socket, everybody recognizes it is your problem to solve, not his. Well, women with breast cancer are warriors also. I have been to war, and I still am. So is every woman who has had one or both breasts amputated because of the cancer which is becoming the primary physical scourge of our times. For me, my scars are an honorable reminder that I may be a casualty in the cosmic war against radiation, animal fat, hormones, air pollution, McDonald's, hamburgers, and red dye number two. But the fight is still going on, and I am very much a part of it. I refuse to have my scars hidden or trivialized behind lamb's wool or silicone gel. I refuse to be reduced in my eyes or in the eyes of others from warrior to mere victim, simply because it would render me a fraction more acceptable or less dangerous to the still complacent, those who believe that if you cover up a problem, it ceases to exist. I refuse to hide my body simply because it would make a womanphobic world more comfortable. And as I sat in this doctor's office trying to order my perceptions of what had just occurred, I realized that the attitude towards prosthesis after breast cancer is merely an index of this society's attitudes toward women in general as decoration and externally defined sex object. The last piece I'm going to read is some information that whenever I read to predominantly women's group, I would like to share with you because I think that it is important. And it is results of, these are pieces that resulted from research that I did while I was writing this. Any information about the prevention or treatment of breast cancer which might possibly threaten the vested interests of the American medical establishment is difficult to acquire in this country. Only through continuing scrutiny of various non-mainstream sources of information, such as the alternative and the women's presses, can a picture of new possibilities for prevention and treatment of breast cancer emerge. Much of this secrecy is engineered by the American Cancer Society, which has become, quote, the loudest voice of the cancer establishment. The American Cancer Society is the largest philanthropic institution in the United States and the world's largest non-religious charity. Yet the National Information Bureau, which is a charity watchdog organization, has listed the ACS among the groups which do not meet its standards. During the past decade, the American Cancer Society has collected over $1 billion from the American public. In 1977, it had a $176 million fund balance. Yet less than 15% of its budget was spent on assisting cancer patients. Any holistic approach to the problem of cancer is viewed by the American Cancer Society with suspicion and with alarm. As a body, it has consistently focused upon treatment rather than prevention of cancer, and then only upon those treatments sanctioned by the most conservative branches of Western medicine. This is not too strange, I think, if we remember that we live in an economy which is a profit economy, which is based on profit rather than human need. And there is no profit in the prevention of cancer, there is only profit in the treatment of cancer. In 1976, 70% of the American Cancer Society's research budget went to individuals and institutions with whom ACS's board members were affiliated. And of those board members, 194 of them, one is a labor representative and one is black. And women are not even mentioned. The American Cancer Society was originally established to champion new research into the causes and the cure of cancer. But by its blacklisting of new therapies without testing, the ACS spends much of its remaining budget suppressing new and unconventional ideas and research. Yet studies from other countries have shown interesting results from treatments largely ignored here. European Medicine reports hopeful experiments with immunotherapy, diet, blood work, and treatment with hormones and enzymes such as trypsin. Silencing and political repression by establishment medical journals keeps much vital information about breast cancer underground and away from us, the women whose lives it most affects. Yet even in the United States, there are clinics waging alternative wars against cancer and the medical establishment with varying degrees of success. Breast cancer is on the increase. Every woman should add to her arsenal of information by inquiring into these areas of underground medicine. Who are its leaders and proponents? What are their qualifications? Most important, what is their rate of success in the control of breast cancer? And why is this information not common knowledge? The mortality for breast cancer treated by conventional therapies has not decreased in America in over 40 years. The American Cancer Society and its governmental partner, the National Cancer Institute, have been notoriously indifferent, if not hostile, to the idea of general environmental causes of cancer and the need for regulation and prevention. Since the American medical establishment and the ACS are determined to suppress any cancer information not dependent upon Western medical bias, whether this information is ultimately useful or not, we must pierce this silence ourselves and aggressively seek answers to those questions about new therapies. We must also heed the unavoidable evidence pointing toward the nutritional and environmental aspects of cancer prevention. Cancer is not just another degenerative, unavoidable disease of the aging process. It has distinct and identifiable causes, and these are mainly exposure to chemical and physical agents in our environment. Even in Western medical literature, there is mounting evidence that breast cancer is a chronic and systemic disease. Post-mastectomy women must be vigilantly aware that contrary to the lightning strikes theory, we are the most likely of all women to develop cancer somewhere else in our bodies. Every woman has a militant responsibility to involve herself actively with her own health. We owe ourselves the protection of all the information we can acquire about the treatment of cancer and its causes, as well as about the recent findings concerning immunology, nutrition, environment, and stress. And we owe ourselves this information before we may have a reason to use it. It was very important to me to develop and encourage my own internal sense of power after mastectomy. I needed to rally my energies in such a way as to image myself as a fighter resisting rather than a passive victim suffering. At all times, it felt crucial to me that I make a conscious commitment to survival. It is physically much more important for me to be loving my life rather than to be mourning a breast. I believe it is this love of my life and myself and the careful tending of that love, which was done by women who love and support me, which has been largely responsible for my strong and healthy recovery from the effects of mastectomy. Right after surgery, I had a sense that I would never be able to bear missing the great well of pleasure that I connected with my right breast. That sense has completely passed away, as I have come to realize that the well of feeling is within me. I can never lose that feeling because I own it, because it comes out of myself. I can attach it wherever I wish to, because my feelings are a part of me, my sorrows and my joy. I would never have chosen this path, but I am very glad to be who I am here.
Thank you for joining us today on the Lesbian Radio Show. The reader for today's program has been Audre Lorde, Black lesbian feminist activist, reading at the 13th Moon series produced by Ellen Marie Bissert. I would like to thank Isaaca Siegel for her invaluable assistance in putting this program together. These are the announcements for the Lesbian Radio Show. On Thursday, May 28th, the Harp Band, an all-women's jazz Latin ensemble, will be at Folk City. For information and reservations, call AL4-8449. On Sunday, May 31st at 3 p.m., Lesbian Feminist Liberation will hold a workshop on lesbians and art making, facilitated by Barbara Levy. This is at the Women's Liberation Center at 243 West 20th Street and is for women only. On June 1st, The Glines presents the second annual Gay American Arts Festival, which will run for the entire month of June. Among the events scheduled, on Tuesday, June 2nd, the Gay Community Marching Band, a band composed of lesbians and gay men, will give a free concert at Damrosch Park in Lincoln Center, which is at 66th Street and Broadway, and that concert will happen at 7:30. On Wednesday, June 3rd, Jane Chambers' new play, My Blue Heaven, will open at the Shandall Theater at 137 West 22nd Street at 8 p.m. Also in June, on June 10th, Hillary Morgan will be at Folk City. And on June 21st through the 27th, during Lesbian Pride Week at 7 p.m., the Radical Lesbian Feminist Terrorist Comedy Group will be performing at ATA, which is at 314 West 54th Street. Starting on June 14th, the 4th Annual Women in Jazz Festival. And that is coordinated by the Universal Jazz Coalition. And for more information, you can call 924-5026. Also in June, starting on the 8th and running through the 12th, the National Organization for Women, New York Chapter, will be having an open house week and a series of workshops ranging from feminism, who are we as women and how did we get where we are, to our right to choose, reproductive freedom, to a film strip about lesbianism. For more information on these and other workshops, you should contact Virginia Cornu at the NOW office at 989-7230. Thank you for being with us. I'm Viv Sutherland.